The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We've been exploring the solar system for a bit over 65 years now. And since the earliest days of NASA's formation, the question of whether or not we are alone, whether or not life exists beyond Earth, has been sort of a motivating point for exploration.
Our best shot at finding life beyond Earth could be on the ice-covered moons of our outer solar system. Planetary scientists believe massive oceans could be churning beneath their surfaces.
To really figure out whether or not the origin of life is easy and whether or not there's a second origin of life in our own backyard, we need to go to worlds where life could be alive today.
But to know for sure, they need tools that can detect alien life forms. And these life forms are likely to be tiny creatures, like bacteria, the kind of microbes that are super abundant on Earth.
The history of life on our planet is microbial, right? So they were the first life forms on our planet. Microbes are our friends.
Planetary scientists are searching for clues about how life evolved here on Earth. And they're getting help from researchers studying the microbes that inhabit our planet's most extreme and otherworldly environments.
Carbon is the ultimate building block for all of life as we know it. And so we can look on Earth at places like in the Arctic and in the Antarctic, and we can look at what kinds of carbon compounds tell us different things about the biological origin. And then that information serves as our toolkit for how we would interpret results from a world like Europa.
The insights from their experiments will be crucial for devising technologies that can figure out whether or not we're alone in the universe. From the Wall Street Journal, this is The Future of Everything. I'm Anthony Green. For now, Antarctica is the closest we can get to places like Europa or Enceladus, the icy moons that scientists think could host life. The next mission to Europa will launch sometime in the 2020s. 2 weeks ago, we brought you the first part of our reporting from the frozen continent, where roboticists are testing machines that could help them explore ocean worlds beyond Earth. The Wall Street Journal's Daniela Hernandez spent some time in Antarctica with a team of researchers trying to discover new extreme microbes and the uncharted places where they might be thriving. What do they eat and breathe? Where do they live? And how many of them are there? What they unearth could help robotic space explorers to know where and what to look for in their search for life, and to achieve their ultimate goal, to understand the origins of life, not just on our home planet, but in the universe.
Looking at the, you know, where life exists, what the edges of life are, the extremes, the limits, helps us understand life in general. Previously, you know, 100 years ago, we thought that life couldn't exist at extreme hot or cold temperatures. Now we know it can, right? So we only learn that by investigating these extremes.
That's Peter Doran. He studies an area of Antarctica known as the Dry Valleys. It's a rocky brown terrain dotted with frozen lakes and glaciers. We met him at one of the camps there.
This is Lake Frixel Camp. I've been coming here about 25 years, something like that. I've lost count. So while we're walking up here, you can see these lines on the hill right there. Those are old lake levels. So the lake in the valley has been that high in the past. It's been almost 300 meters higher than it is now in the past. Back about 15,000 years ago, there was a lot of ice in the basin that's not here now. The dry valleys look very much like Mars as we know it. There's no vegetation. There's nothing in the scene besides the rocks. It's a very barren landscape. It's not a place that supports higher orders of life, like anything bigger than microscopic. It was interesting, when Scott came through, he called it the Valley of the Dead.
He's referring to Robert Falcon Scott. He was an early explorer of the continent and the second to reach the South Pole.
I think it's the opposite. It's not the Valley of the Dead, it's the Valley of the Very Small. When you come here and you look at it with modern tools, it's anything but that. There's things living in the lake that love living in the lake. There's things in the soil. There's things living in the rocks.
One of those modern tools is called SkyTEM. It's a giant sensor that hangs from a helicopter through a bunch of wires. Some call it the dream catcher because it sort of looks like one. As it flies over the frozen surface, it can detect what's lurking below. It's a bit like an X-ray, but for ice. This is the second time Peter has used the instrument in Antarctica. After showing us around camp, Peter headed to a nearby refueling station to oversee experiments.
That, I think that's the helo you came on, and it's going back to get fuel at Marble Point. And that's the one that's going to take me away.
We joined him at Marble Point the next day.
The big helicopter is the one that flies the SkyTEM. We were going to do two missions today, and we just learned we can do three. So the sensor is right there.
Oh, that big thing.
Yeah. So you guys are going to want to get set up pretty fast because they're going to start getting it ready. They're going to start the generator. In fact, they're walking out there now to get ready. Let's just move over here first. Okay. Lars is out there, and he's getting set up to launch.
Only the pilot was allowed to fly in the helicopter carrying SkyTEM. So inside a tent that doubles as an office, Peter analyzes data and plans other experiments.
So this next flight, we're going into Taylor Valley, and we're going into this closed basin. It's a big bowl, and it has a history of lake occupation. And right now there's no lake there. There's just this little tiny pond in the bottom. And so we want to see what water is still there underground from that lake.
Why do you need to know that?
From a biological standpoint, wherever you have water, you have the potential for life.
One of Peter's collaborators, microbiologist Jill McCookie, is particularly interested in Antarctica's hidden habitats. Like Peter, she's been studying Antarctica for roughly 20 years. He took over for her at Marble Point before we arrived.
So that's, you know, really the main focus of Jill. Where we find these groundwater systems, there's going to be a new ecosystem that we didn't know existed. You know, you think of all of Antarctica with all this new water being discovered, that's a whole new ecosystem. There's microbes living down there.
SkyTEM data is only the first step in taking a census of what lives in Antarctica's wide expanse. It's like having an address, but not the details of who the inhabitants are and what they're like.
So we can tell where the water is and we can give some idea of the nature of the water, but we can't tell anything about what's living there. That's going to be per sampling that does that.
Peter Doran, structure Peter and Doran, stuff. Robin on Helo Ops.
Hi, Robin, go ahead.
Are those guys ready to get a pickup?
Thank you for a great day.
Yeah.
We took a helicopter back to our camp. Nearby was a unique place called Blood Falls. It's a salty, iron-rich waterfall that leaks water located beneath a giant glacier. Because of the iron, the water turns red, just like blood. It looks like it's hemorrhaging. Scientists think Europa and Enceladus could have similar cracks from which their ocean's hidden life forms could emerge. For Jill, Blood Falls is special because it oozes microbes, and she can access them without having to drill through the ice.
So we're walking into the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, where Jill McCookie works. This is the first time I'm seeing her since we were both in Antarctica in the Dry Valleys. Hopefully she's in her office already since we're here early.
Hi! It's so nice to see you!
Hey, good to see you too! How have you been?
Good. We're both wearing normal clothes this time.
I know. It's like, I almost don't recognize you.
Yeah.
Welcome to Knoxville.
Jill shows us her library of microbes. It's filled with test tubes and petri dishes where Antarctic creatures are growing.
So these contain samples that I've collected from around Blood Falls and other locales in Antarctica since I first started going down in 2001. We have close to 100 microbes from different Antarctic environments that we're in the process of describing.
How did you end up working on this?
How did I end up working on Blood Falls? I've always loved cold environments. I've always loved the snow, loved snowboarding, all of that. And so when I first started graduate school, my glaciology professor happened to be a gentleman named Andrew Fountain, who worked in the McMurdo Dry Valleys and was showing pictures of his research and glaciers around the world, and I was just in heaven. And then he showed a picture of this thing called Blood Falls. And I was just fascinated, and I raised my hand and was like, what microbes are living in there?
So for people who haven't been to Blood Falls and the Dry Valleys, what is it like to be there?
You know, for me, it's become almost like a second home. You know, I've been there a lot, and I love working there, but it's also grueling. There's times when it's a bright sunny day and it's lovely working out there, and then there's other times where it's just absolutely freezing. To me, it always feels like you're on a mission, right? You're in this remote camp. You're sleeping in a tent. The landscape is very dramatic and prehistoric in a way. There's no trees. You're riding over this ice cover, you know, and you see Blood Falls around the corner, and that's your target. It's very otherworldly. I imagine that's what working on another planet might be like.
Are you doing any experiments with the samples that you collected at Blood Falls?
Okay, yeah. So can you give us a couple minutes to get that organized?
While Jill sets up, a graduate student named Caleb Schuler shows us an ice probe the team is building to access microbes living below layers of ice.
Where should we go to now? We don't want to disturb you too much.
You can come over here. I'm just doing some... Okay, so this is a part of the melt probe, and it's just like a cylinder, right? And these glaciers and stuff in Antarctica, if you want to sample something underneath it, you have to have a way to get through. And typically they use hot water drills, and those can be costly. So there's alternatives out there, and one of them would be a melt probe.
It's called the Ice Diver, and it uses heat to melt ice so that microbiologists like Caleb and Jill can access places where communities of microbes could be hiding. The tool also has a compartment for collecting samples. It has the potential to transform their research by giving them access to more habitats. They've tested it in the Arctic, but it's still in development.
So this portion is the sampling portion, and first thing is, how do we clean this before it goes in? And now the second part is, how do we know the sample that we're collecting is actually a sample that we want, right? So as you're melting down through the ice, is what you're melting through going to influence your sample beneath it? So if we sample something, we find these bacteria down there, we want to know that that's what's actually down there, and it's not just from us handling it or us not cleaning it properly.
One of the things that I find really interesting is that, you know, we want to study these places that are understudied and mm-hmm. mysterious because of that. And they also give us hints as to what it might be like to go to Mars again, mm-hmm. or Europa, or Enceladus.
Absolutely.
And there, it's also really important to keep those environments pristine because you don't want to contaminate
right.
them, right? So you're doing that
Absolutely.
Here, it seems.
Yeah. Our process of cleaning it before we go into the glacier is kind of just like a fundamental step in getting to that end goal. Hopefully, we'll be able to deploy the probe somewhere down in Antarctica. That's the dream, outside of sending it to Europa. I mean, that would be cool too, but, you know, I can't go with it.
The probes that go to Europa will need to work without human help. Jill can bring microbes back from Antarctica, but planetary scientists won't be able to do that for the icy moon. They'll only be able to get back data. So researchers need to figure out what kind of signals they need to measure to maximize their chances for detecting alien life. With that knowledge in hand, they can then program their probes to recognize alien creatures. The hunt starts with the kinds of experiments Jill and her team are doing to understand the microbes living in extreme environments here on Earth.
So this is the space that we use to work with our samples from Blood Falls and other places in Antarctica. Yeah, we can put in the hood, I think.
The hood looks like the meat display cases you'd see at the supermarket. It sucks out air to keep your samples clean.
So this is material that we collected from the surface that was part of that iron-rich visual component that you see at Blood Falls.
The sample is in a small tube. It's a salmon color and looks like it has the consistency of pate.
Okay, we need some more of these scupulas. No, I need the little skinny one, the one that looks like a metal spatula. Yeah, we might have to wait a little bit for this to defrost just a little bit.
After it thaws, Jill scoops it into smaller containers for testing.
This is just working really well because it's slushy. This is exactly the stuff that you see at the surface of Blood Falls.
So these samples here that you just put in these tiny test tubes,
yeah.
What happens to them next?
So some of the tubes will be used for extracting DNA so we can do a molecular analysis of the sample and see if we can identify who's there and what genes are present. The other container that we put some subsample into, we'll try to use to cultivate out microorganisms. We're really interested in what we call ecologically relevant organisms, so some of the more abundant microbes in our samples, the microorganisms that might be utilizing iron or sulfur or be adapted to the cold and salt conditions. We'd like to know more about them to better understand blood falls.
To get the microbes to grow, the researchers have to recreate Antarctica's harsh subglacial environment in their lab in Knoxville. To do that, they use a setup that looks like a beer tap, but instead of alcohol, it serves up different gases. Abigail Jarrett shows us how it works.
So this is our gassing station. So you can see we have some compressed gas cylinders, super exciting.
It's like nitrogen and carbon dioxide, and what else you got?
Ultra pure air, and then we have some hydrogen and nitrogen gas. And ultimately what happens is we can put lots of different gases in bottles, and then we can grow stuff in them.
She's about to do some experiments with a bottle filled with a red liquid. The color comes from an iron-containing mineral they think the microbes need. It's supposed to mimic blood falls. The first step is to remove the oxygen to simulate the environment beneath blood falls. In the presence of the iron-loving microbes, that red turns black.
Okay, so she showed you her controls that have no microorganisms in them. And you can see that the iron is still really this bright, rusty red. And then when you look at the cultures she's incubated with her microorganism, you can see that it's gone black. And so the mineral has changed from being in the presence of this microorganism. And we're still trying to figure out everything that's going on.
This kind of data can also help them detect microbes. Jill has found that some produce stinky smells as they grow. Tracing those scents can lead scientists to where the microbes are, like a dog finding its owner by sniffing for their smell. That homing strategy can be applied not just on Earth, but on frozen moons, and it's less work-intensive than drilling through ice.
We talked about the challenges of going to Antarctica, so amplify that with the challenges of going to a place like Europa or Enceladus. We're still working towards being able to drill in these ice covers, but it's a long way off. Most of the measurements that NASA scientists are making are sniffing around the surface of the planet or landing and looking at the surface. And so perhaps blood falls can tell us something about what signals, what clues a subsurface ecosystem leaves on the surface as it comes out.
And so when we get down to the surface of Europa, we want to scoop up samples. And among other things, we want to look for any signs of life. We want to look for what we call biosignatures.
That's Kevin Hand. He's a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, and he's developing future missions to Europa. To understand how best to look for life there, he's working with microbes with a contraption he calls Europa in a Can. It takes up a whole room in his lab.
And so one of the things that we've done with our Europa in a Can here on Earth is we've actually put microbes in there, put them under the temperature and pressure and irradiation conditions that they would experience on Europa. And we then examined the data to see whether or not we could still figure out that the leftover material was derived from microbes. And the answer is yes.
That tells them that they're on the right track. The microbes he's working on come from another building at JPL. Kevin is also getting ready to test microbes from Antarctica and the bottom of the ocean.
So all of these microbes in extreme environments from around planet Earth serve as interesting little case studies in the types of life that could potentially survive on a world like Europa.
Yesterday, we spent the day with Jill McCookie. She says hello.
Excellent. Hi, Jill.
Down in Knoxville. Do you plan on using any of the microbes that she's finding down there to do your Europa experiments here?
Oh, I want to. I got to get some microbes from her.
It's possible her Antarctic microbes have adapted to life in similar ways as their potential European cousins.
Part of what's fascinating about work that's being done by people like Jill is that they're going to these extreme environments and looking at the ways in which microbes find the elements needed to build life. So blood falls, you got a bunch of iron and some sulfur in there, and that's the biochemical battery that makes life tick.
Our battery runs on oxygen, but the microbes Jill studies have adapted to breathe iron.
How might her research in her lab help you?
As we explore these extreme environments on Earth, we really hone our discovery skills for seeing how life on Earth expresses itself in different environments. The blood falls environment in Antarctica is just so dramatic. You got this red material all over the place. I can only hope that someday we land on the surface of Europa in an environment that's kind of like the Europa version of blood falls Antarctica, and we scoop up a little material and find that the discoloration is made from microbes within Europa's ocean coming up to the surface. I want to get out there and see if there's another way to get the business of life done. Is there something other than DNA, RNA, and proteins? Or is that the best biochemical solution? To answer that question and to really figure out whether or not the origin of life is easy and whether or not there's a second origin of life in our own backyard, we need to go to worlds where life could be alive today. And the worlds that are prime for that kind of exploration are worlds like Europa and Enceladus and Titan.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was reported and produced by Daniela Hernandez, with help from Alexander Hotz and Lee Camping Carter. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Green.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.